In a world increasingly stubborn at keeping nationalistic policies, instead of embracing regional and inclusive tones, one man has consistently kept a regional voice strong despite these trying times. Former President José Ramos Horta was formerly the president of Timor-Leste and a co-recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize that he won back in 1996. The Nobel Committee going so much as saying that Ramos Horta was the leading international spokesperson for East Timor's cause since 1975. He was even featured in a few movies, such as the documentary The Diplomat, as well as being played by Oscar Isaac in the 2009 film Balibo, that tells the story of the Balibo Five and the events preceding the Indonesian occupation of East Timor. Such is the illustrious career of the seasoned statesman. Mr. Ramos Horta, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It's very rare do we get a Nobel laureate in the house, but it's even rarer that we get a Nobel Peace Prize laureate as well as a former president to join us. Hence, the first question would be on your observation of Malaysia and how it has been since the elections of last year.
Well, myself and many others who keep interest, close eye, follow the development in Southeast Asia, including in Malaysia, we were surprised, but pleasantly surprised, that the duo Anwar Ibrahim and Mahathir Anwar Ibrahim, and the great Dr. Aziza, they won the election, and it was peaceful, and all sides accepted the result, and that marked also a real turning point in politics in Malaysia, and brought some new hope to democracy in Southeast Asia as a whole.
And the conversation has always been about these trying times, as I mentioned in the opening statement, where plenty of countries around the world are now arguing more right-wing policies. They are arguing more nationalistic policies. Do you think that Southeast Asia or ASEAN has that special sauce, as it may be called, to get it done in terms of getting all the neighbours together, getting the regional arguments out there and saying, you know what, despite the big economies of the West, we can do it?
I would say two things on ASEAN. Impressive achievement since the foundation, since the Cold War, since the Vietnam War. The economics of Southeast Asia, the living conditions of the people, dramatic transformation. So ASEAN leaders, ASEAN peoples, to be congratulated for the achievements. However, there are still enormous challenges. The more clear ones are on the security front, on the situation in Myanmar. It's not only the situation, dramatic situation of the Rohingya in Rakhine State, but the other national ethnic groups, they're still waging insurgency against central government, the government inability to resolve this deep-seated problem. Then you have a low-level intensity conflict in southern Thailand. Then you have problems in the Philippines, in Mindanao area. So ASEAN leaders, I'm sure, are aware of these challenges and will do their best to resolve them.
When you were the president of East Timor, Timor-Leste, what were the kind of challenges that you had to face then that you still see happening right now? Because some of the conflicts that you mentioned, they have been around for ages.
Yeah. Today, Timor-Leste, 16, 70 years after independence, we started from absolute zero. The country was thoroughly destroyed. no institution to speak of, no economy to speak of, a people uprooted, traumatized. We had to deal with matters of the soul and heart, heal the wounds, reconcile our people, and build from scratch state institutions with next to no money. Our first budget, 2002-2003, was $68 million US. Can you imagine? Of course, we did have a lot of international assistance. And I must say here, Malaysia under Dr. Mahathir in 1999-2000 played a significant role, a leading role within the region, within ASEAN, to help stabilize the situation in Timor-Leste twice. In 1999-2000, till 2002-2003, and then in 2006, when we had a major security political crisis in Timor-Leste, I was the one who phoned the Malaysian government at the time, please send out some security elements to help stabilize. So we had, and within six days, Malaysia deployed forces. So that was impressive. A developing country deployed troops in several thousand miles away very, very quickly, faster than you would do through the UN system, and high-quality troops, equipment, helicopters, aircraft, Navy ship, in, of course, a partnership with Australia, New Zealand, Portugal. They helped us stabilize the situation. And Malaysia has been under Mahathir has been in forefront of helping Timor-Leste, stabilizing and giving us plenty of opportunities for human resources development here. But 16 years after, well, we still face challenges of addressing issues of poverty, of malnutrition. But one thing is certain, the country is peaceful, we have zero political violence, we don't have organized crime, and no major political instability. We do have tension, challenges, but this all happened in the confines of the parliament or in the media.
The first thing that Tun Dr. Mahathir said when he took the administration, or the new administration, is that the rule of law, the rule of government or governance have to prevail. This has been highlighted in many of the actions that the government has been taken since, including properly using the courts to prosecute what they believe to be wrongdoers, and everybody has a right to defend themselves. And the trial of Dato' Sri Najib Tun Razak is coming soon, just next week, and he has his day in court to defend himself. These things, people tend to take for granted when we talk about, you know, good governance. It's like a second nature. But not many people forget that many places, particularly in ASEAN, still do not have that good governance to speak of. Do you think that ASEAN must do more in terms of ensuring good governance is being applied in all the ASEAN member countries?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, one area where ASEAN has different degrees of achievement in terms of good governance. Some countries have done remarkably well. I would say Indonesia in the last 17 years, 18 years, since the fall of Suharto, has done remarkably well. They have carried out reform of the armed forces, of the judiciary. They set up a very aggressive, independent anti-corruption commission with vast powers, powers of arrest, and so on. But they themselves, they know it's a major challenge still ahead. And that's happened throughout ASEAN. On top of the fact that ASEAN is the only organization in the world where you have only 10 countries, vast, different in political systems. You have two one-party states, Vietnam and Laos. You have an absolutist monarchy in Brunei. You have a very dynamic democracy in Indonesia. You have a new democracy emerging in Malaysia. You have a hybrid democracy in Singapore, very successful. I'm a great admirer of Singapore and the way Lee Kuan Yew and the Singaporeans evolve gradually more and more politically open and maintaining that country absolutely stable, safe. And then you have other countries. So it's really very diverse in every sense. But at the same time, it has been very successful. It's the only, what the interesting thing about ASEAN is that it's the only regional organization where the summits are attended, eagerly attended by superpowers. No other regional organization anywhere in the world, whether Africa, whether Latin America, even Europe, you have the US president flying in, the president of China, Japan, South of Korea, course. Russia, India, all wanting to have meetings, ASEAN plus.
The key word that you mentioned is eagerly attending. It's not a chore.
Eagerly
attending. They see this as a strategic conversation to be had. Yeah. Mr. President, we'll take a short break. But when we come back, we'll discuss a little bit more about the superpowers that may be and the arrival of them in ASEAN. Don't go anywhere. You're joining me on Agenda Awani, and my guest for today is former President of Timor-Leste and Nobel Peace Prize laureate, President José Ramos Horta. Of course, when we left off, we were talking about how the superpowers descend on ASEAN every year for the ASEAN summit. We're talking about China, we're talking about America, and BRICS membership as well. And the interesting note here is that when we look at the Malaysian context, the previous administration under Barisan Nasional, they were very close to China. Many of the mega projects, even you know subcontracts, tend to go to Chinese companies. When the new administration took over, these kind of warm relationship, I wouldn't have said cool, but have perhaps paused. Do you think that with the new change of reception or receptiveness towards China, is this a good path for Malaysia to take, particularly when we see Europe and the US having their own challenges?
Well, when you are trying to comment or observe on the policies of someone like Dr. Mahathir, you know, I would say I'm a novice, apprentice. It's a bit like me going to Rome and chat with the Pope and advising the Pope on how to run the Catholic Church in the world. So having said that, I think Prime Minister Mahathir, the government, is absolutely right. Because sometimes, yes, when you transition from a previous government of many years, built up some entrenched interest, relationship with China or whoever, the new government that has been in opposition has been watching disquiet about this relationship. Yet it's very important to review. And as Dr. Mahathir himself said, and I read about it, it's not like he's not interested, Malaysia is no longer interested in relations with China. It is. But it has to carefully review it. And that's absolutely correct. You do it with China, you do it with the United States, or with Japan. But and Malaysia has enormous experience, decades of diplomatic experience on many issues. And it will know how to best serve its interests, the interests of ASEAN and accommodating what is indisputably the rising superpower. I view today we have a new bipolar wall. One is centered still around Washington, the other one is Beijing. And the difference in the past, the Cold War, you have bipolar wall centered around Washington and Moscow. But the then Soviet Union did not have underneath it, behind it, a strong economy that sustained then it is international status as a superpower. Only the warhead, nuclear warhead, that made Soviet Union a superpower. While China, it has nuclear warheads, it has an incredible number of troops.
But the strong economy.
And a strong economy. And far more even than the United States has, in the sense China is putting money everywhere around the world, including in the U.S., maybe $2 trillion in the U.S. So it is a truly global power.
But it's not always good that that China puts its money everywhere. We've seen in Pakistan, for instance, in some areas in the Indian Ocean where countries are completely bankrupt, Sri Lanka, you name it.
You know, when I read about it, I smile. Why? Where these criticisms or alert come from? Come from the United States, from the European Union. Well, how many countries suffer in the hands of IMF, of the World Bank, of Washington, and so on, over decades? Malaysia escaped the financial crisis in 1997-98.
Yes.
Indonesia didn't. South Korea didn't escape. And over decades, countries in Africa subjected to IMF so-called structural reforms saw infant mortality increase dramatically, malnutrition, hunger, and all. And this came from the Washington consensus, came from Western policies. And how many countries, look at Brazil, was profoundly indebted, billions and billions of dollars out to IMF. Well, it didn't out to China. So it's ironic that some people now are saying, be careful with the debt. Well, of course, each country has to be careful, whether with China or whether with Russia or whether with the United States. But the one thing about China is, over the years, because the relationship of China with Africa particularly and others is not new. It way back in the 60s, when China is still poor, China built the railway between Zambia and Tanzania. Western countries, the World Bank at the time, refused to finance because they say not realistic. The Chinese did it. And whenever, way back then, recipient countries were not able to pay the debt, it was renegotiated and it was written off. I'm not suggesting they are going to write off the debt of Pakistan, but they're always open to renegotiate the debt because it's also in their interest to keep the strategic relationship with this country. Because if you, China, bulldoze, bully Pakistan or other countries because of the debt, well, very difficult then to control popular emotions.
But surely,
so they know that, and so I doubt that there will not be a reasonable resolution if they are not able to pay the debt.
Any form of monopoly is not good. That's what the economic professors normally tell us. And right now, there seems to be some inconsistency coming out of Washington. Europe has its very serious tribulations coming out of Brexit and the negotiations that seem to never end. Do you think that China right now is capitalizing on the tribulations that the other regions are currently undergoing and therefore capitalizing their moment now? Is this the century of China?
Well, I would say this is a century of Asia, But there are dangers not to take things for granted. Will China be able to manage the claims, the overlapping claims with other countries or in South China Sea? Will China and India be able to resolve, to manage their relationship? After all, we have two nuclear superpowers. One is China, and the India, they are neighbors. They are going to be partners or they are going to be rivals. So it's extremely important that China and India, I said earlier, we are in a bipolar world, Beijing and Washington, but do not discount a possibility 10, 20 years from now, maybe longer, a tripolar world, Washington, Delhi, and Beijing. And that's going to require a lot of diplomatic skills on all sides to manage it.
Otherwise, a lot of restraint, I presume.
A lot of restraint, a lot of dialogue to avoid mistrust, because the absence of dialogue between leaders create mistrust. And so it's very important that India and China maintain regular dialogue, because if they fail, there'll be no Asia Century. You cannot have an Asia Century when you have India and China in a, I wouldn't say collision course, but could happen, or even if they are not cooperating. But then there are still the inability of China, South Korea, and Japan to resolve World War II legacies. The three East Asian countries, Northeast Asian countries, if they were to partner up,
they would be a super
extraordinary
force
for Asia. But that's almost like a pipe dream.
Mr. President, we have to end it here. And it has been a pleasant discussion. I've been speaking to former President José Ramos Horta, the former president of Timor-Leste. Thank you very much.